overrides, like in as far as real estate building is concerned. And in other places, he will say that there's a partial override, like in the case of the laws of evidence as far as collecting loans are concerned. And in one of the chuvas that we didn't read, he limits this to some extent. I now want to get to this case where we will see that he gets really, and this is the one that, of course, is quoted. All the others are not quoted. This is the one that's quoted. There's a selective quotation of the Rashi. Ma'aseh ha'yavah parapinyon. Ma'aseh ha'yavah parapinyon. Ve'ruven shehesiet bito le'ya le'shimon. Ve'echnis lo ichmasach mamon b'nadunya. So Reuven married his daughter off to Shimon and gave her a substantial amount of money as a dowry. The Yaldalo bat, and she bore a daughter. The Achakach meta Leah, then the wife died. The Achakach, the Achazman meta gamkein habat Yaldalo, and then the daughter died. ועכשיו עמד ראובן וטבע בדיני הגויים שיחזיר לו אותו ממון הנדוניה שהכניס לו אם ליביתו. Now the father-in-law wants the return of the dowry. Right? So you can see there's a tragedy here. A young girl was married off to a man. Within a short period of time she died after giving birth, and then the daughter died. It could have all been in a relatively short period of time. The father doesn't want the husband to collect the dowry when he no longer is married to his daughter, or if they don't have any issue. V'achal pisha ha'bal yoresh et ishto v'ha'av et bito b'dinei Yisrael, even though according to Jewish law the husband inherits the wife and he also inherits his daughter, to'ein v'omer she'ein l'chashluyu shat ha'bal, he claims that one should not pay any attention to the inheritance rights of the husband, kevan shakol yodim shehem holchim b'dinei hagoyim. All people know that the people of Perim Yudpinyon follow the laws of Provence. Bare kol anosei isha sham, anyone who marries a woman in that part of the world, ke'ilu hipnake. It's as if there was a condition that under these circumstances, where the daughter would die without issue, or with the issue also dying, with the grandchild also dying, the dowry reverts to the father-in-law. That in Arabia, even though the general rule is that a ketuvah is not collectible from non-real property, in Arabia, where the main means of value is camels rather than land, the wife can collect her ketubah from a camel. V'yod samcho ha-ga'onim v'tiknu, and furthermore there was a takana of the ga'onim that says, she'ehe kol ba'al chov govem et ha-polim v'yatmi, that any creditor can collect the portable of the orphans, v'ha'yurushat ha'vav v'nechsei ha'bat to'ein, and as far as the husband inheriting his daughter, to'ein she'amelech ha'kach b'ni musav, that she'kol she'amut ha'vlad tov zman yadua, that so long as the child dies within a certain fixed period of time, she'yehei ma she'yesh lo mitzad ha'ein v'yorshei ha'ein v'dina d'malchut ha'din. That's the question. Okay? Tshuva. Now here's the Rashba's answer. He first gives the halachic answer, and then he gives his emotional answer. Tshuva. Kol davar shebamon, mamon t'na'o kayam. Any monetary clause is always valid. Uv'yemet amru, she'matnin v'ki'inyan zeh, that people can make such clauses, there's this. In Yerushalmi it says that if they make an explicit clause at the time of the marriage that if the wife should die without children, the dowry should revert to the father, to the
father's house, this is a valid clause. Omosif ani al zeh, shebachol makom shenhagul hatnot valasot kazeh nai. In any place where such a clause is an explicit, is explicitly made, afilu hanosim sham stam gavim mehem emeta v'lo banim. And even a marriage which didn't have this clause explicitly written into the ketubah, it's an implicit clause, and therefore, in a place where the custom was like the Yerushalmi, which says that if the young wife should die without children, the dowry reverts to her father, even if this is not explicitly stated in the ketubah, it's understood that this is an implicit clause. Shekol ha-nosei stam al da'at ha-nohek sham b'Yisrael nosei. Because anyone who marries in such a place marries according to the local custom. This is what the Mishnah meant, that Hillel Hazaken Hayad Doresh Lashon Hedyo. That once, whatever the local clauses are, if they are the common practice, then even if a marriage took place without this clause being stated explicitly, it's valid. So the Rashba's answer is, any such clause, if it's explicit, it's certainly valid, and if it's common practice, and therefore implicit, it's also valid without being made explicit. And now he blows his top. Umikol makom, then hog kain of neshahu mishpat goyim, but to do this, to engage in such a practice, because this is what the non-Jews do, b'emet nirah li she'asur, l'fi shehu machakeh et ha'goyim, because he's now imitating the non-Jews. V'zehu she'ezhirat Torah lefneihem v'lo lefnei goyim. That's what the Torah says, that you should appear before the Jewish courts and not before the non-Jewish courts. V'af al pi she'shneihem rotzim b'kach, and even if they both or desire this, who davar sheba mamon, shelo hinicha Torah et ha'am, shehu lenachala lo al rutzonam, sheyakru et chukot ha'goyim v'dineihem. The Torah did not allow the Jewish people to imitate the goyim. V'lo od, ela afilu la'amod lefneihem l'din, afilu b'davar shedineihem k'din Yisrael. Not only that, we're not allowed to appear before the non-Jewish courts, even when they're adjudicating according to Jewish law. Al kain anu pot meim makom ha-mishpat v'yacham makom Torah v'yitron da'at, your town courts, which after all is a place of learning, eich matnu yad l'klal dvarim elu sh'asratan Torah shleima shalom. How did you allow such things which our Torah prohibits?
That what he said before. No, not really. He's saying, you come to me and I've got flexibility, but you go somewhere else, you're out of line.
No, well, he's saying something a little bit different. I think what he's saying is let's try to think about what he's saying, but let's read a little bit further. What he's saying is, strictly speaking, as far as the laws of contract is concerned, such a contract is valid on the basis of custom. But how in the world could such a custom ever gotten established? How could any such ill-gotten gains benefit someone who inherits not according to our law? Someone who brings proof to this from the fact that camels were considered as subject to lien in Arabia, it makes a mistake. In principle, a ketubah should be collectible even from non-real goods. The minai b'afilu miglima the al katfei. You take it. We still write in our ketubah even up to the shirt that's on my back. Ella sheshamu rabbanon devrei Rabbi Meir she'ein smichata isha chaskar lahem mishum gevaita l'zman ruba. That a woman doesn't rely on collecting from non-real property because she doesn't expect to collect the ketubah right away, and therefore there's really no lien on non-real property. Uba Arabia shekol iskehem begmalim. In Arabia, where all monetary transactions are based on camels, they would get rid of real property in order to acquire camels. And the Gaonim who enacted the fact that creditors can collect from orphans or non-real property, They wanted to make loans more readily available, and therefore they allowed collectability even from non-real property. So now this is what you were saying, Danny. The leaders of the generation can institute such rules. But to derive from this the idea that you're going to follow the laws of the Goyim and their enactments, chas v'shalom la'am kadosh lenhel kach. V'kol shekein imata yosifu lachto la'akon achalata av al abanim, and they even go further to eliminate the inheritance of the father from the children, v'sochal mishenet kaner haratzut zazeh v'oseh eile me'pil chomot ha'torah. He's tearing down the walls of the Torah. Oker shoresh va'anaf. He's uprooting root and branch. Va'atorah miyadot tavakesh. And the Torah will demand its retribution from him. Imarveh honot v'zeh b'po'al kapav nokesh. And someone who increases his richness from this is doing damage with his own hands. V'omer ani shekol hasomech v'zeh l'omar shemutah mishum dina d'malchuta. To'eh v'gazlanhu v'gzeila yashiv. He's in error, and he's a thief, and he should return his stealing. V'chasle da'afilu gzeila yashiv rasha nikri v'imno markein. And if you follow this law, but lo yirushat v'no habchol, the laws of inheritance of the eldest son that he gets a double portion will be eliminated. The kol hanachalot of the Kohen Achalot, the Tirash Abatim Abadim, and a daughter will be an heir along with a son. Uveklal Oker Kol Dinei HaTorah Shlema, and you're uprooting all of the laws of the Torah. Umal Lanu L'Sifrei HaKodesh Mukdashim Shechibu Lanu Rebbe V'Yachar Rabin V'Ravashi. What's the use of all of the laws that were written in the Mishnah by Rebbe, and that is the Mishnah and the Gemara, Rabin and Ravashi? Yilmedu et pneiem dinei hagoyim, v'yivnu lehem bamot tlu'ot v'tatei hamidvasei hagoyim. Chalila lo tiye kezot Yisrael has v'shalom.
Everything opposite of what you just said.
Everything opposite of what he's been saying before. He's gotten very touchy on this issue.
Which came first?
It's not an issue of what came first. What is he saying?
I think he wants jurisdiction.
I don't think that what he wants is jurisdiction. I don't think that this is an issue that he wants to be the sole one that's deciding. I think that what's at issue here is ideology is corrupted. In other words, the key here is the inheritance of the daughter. Not that it's results-oriented. I think that what's happened here, what would be so terrible? I mean, a man can decide to give whatever he wants to his daughter. Right? And there have been takanot of the ketubah, chatzi zachar. There have been always enactments over the ages which make arrangements for the daughter's right to inherit. What I think is happening here is that he's touchy specifically on the issue of inheritance. And he's touchy specifically on the issue of inheritance because the Jewish religion as a whole was attacked because of the unfair treatment of the daughter as opposed to the son, and also the archaic notion that the eldest son should inherit a double portion. Now, I don't know what the custom is in present-day community. When I inherited property from my parents, from my father, I did not take two-thirds and give my brother a third. We split the property half and half. And I don't anticipate, I do not think that today, in the current Jewish, who knows what it will be tomorrow, I don't think that yesterday in the Jewish community, the idea that a father will let his daughters share equally with the sons in the inheritance is such a big deal. But it certainly was ideologically a big deal. In other words, they were attacks on Judaism, both from the point of view of the fact that the women were locked out of inheritance, which was not the case in Islamic law or I'm not sure what the Christian law is, but I assume it was similar to Islamic law on this. And secondly, it was attacked on the issue of giving a double portion to the pechov was some kind of an archaic system which may have made sense in a situation in which one had landed properties and wanted to preserve large estates, but may not have made sense, especially in the Jewish community where they didn't own land anyway. So I think that what we're seeing here is the impact of ideology on the decision. What the Rashba is telling you in this tshuva, the first few sentences, are that any such clause in principle would be valid and override. You can kol tanai shebamamon kayam. But how dare you succumb to the in a change in inheritance law, which is one of the points in which Judaism is attacked, and therefore he's particularly sensitive. So I don't think it's the view is what you're saying, Danny. It's that it's the fact that you're imitating the Goyim here, and it's the fact that you're imitating the Goyim on a sensitive issue. On the issue of whether you can build your porch over the Rishus HaRabim, have some building expansion, or on the issue of whether you can collect the debt if you don't no longer have the original IOU, but it's been renewed by the town clerk. After all, that's also interactive in the sense that once the law has been enacted, then it's an implied piece of the contract that all such debts be collectible. So in terms of the fact that this isn't really a violation of the law, but the imposition of an implied or an explicit contract, theoretically these things don't differ from one another. The difference is coming here because we're dealing with inheritance law, and inheritance law is touchy for the Rashba because it was an issue of ideological attack, not because of anything else. I can't cite a chapter and verse, but I feel traditionally the issues of the fact that daughters don't inherit in Jewish law has been attacked. To show you this, I now want to skip. As I say, this tshuva has been quoted extensively. Not the first part of the tshuva, where the Rashba says that in principle the law should be enforceable, but the second part of the tshuva, where he goes into this diatribe against imitating the Goyim, is of course part of the current propaganda and has been cited repeatedly.
Could we say
that it's not issues, it's Hilchos Nachlos.
Yeah, but that all ties in with she was married. You can't have outside laws involved. The whole family structure was dependent on halacha.
This is not family law. This is inheritance law. It's true.
Dina Demopoulos wouldn't come in here, maybe at all.
He's very angry here. His tone is completely different from his tone elsewhere. Okay, now I want to. This tshuva is famous, but of course, the case is not famous. I now want to move a little bit anachronistically, some three centuries later. To an extraordinarily famous case. I won't tell you who this case is, you may figure it out for yourself. But this was a case in which we have a tshuva of the Marashdam, a tshuva of Rav Moshe Detrani, and a tshuva of Rav Yosef Karo, the Beis Yosef, all dealing with the same case. And this is an amazing tshuva. We will read just the first, and not only do we have a tshuva in the Marashdam and Rav Samuel de Medina, one has five successive tshuvot dealing with this same case, all the ramifications of this case. I may run a little bit longer, but this is an important case. This is certainly the most famous case in the 16th century. And this is all one. There are four pages here. So let me just pass them down and start to read. Does everyone have this? I'll just pass a few more down, but I may not get everybody. All one. Four pages. Okay. Echad mehanu sot shel Portugal. One of the Maranos in Portugal Nisait im Revi Anus v'malchut Portugal, married a certain person, also a Murano, in the kingdom of Portugal. Uvoto ha-malchut, and in Portugal, yesh nimus me-ha-melech v'ha-malchut mizmanim kadmonim, there is an old enactment, shebechol ha-nidoniot, with all dowries, im ma'at ve-im harbei. In all marriages, in fact, there should be more marriages, whether the amount of the dowry is small or a lot. Tihiyena, kishiyamut habaal, if the husband dies, tikacha isha chatsi mehanachasim, shiyashir achrav habaal. The wife is entitled to half of the estate after the husband dies. Kamo shenirah minusach hanimus barur ma'od, as is clear from the Portuguese law, very clearly. The atam met habaal b'Portugal. Now the husband died in Portugal. V'yisha lakcha cheskat hanachasim lefi nimusei hamalchut. The woman took half of the husband's estate according to the laws of Portugal. U kefi hatnai sheitnu b'shat hanisuyim. Maskim l'nimusei hamalchut. And also in accordance with the explicit clause which was written into the marriage contract at the time of the marriage. According to the signed signature of the husband and according to the laws of the land. The woman who took possession of this property, because she was also appointed by her husband to be the executor. Yes, it is. Well, the estate of the children. Afterwards, the woman came with her family to Turkey she came back to Turkey and reverted to Judaism. V'sha'al ha-sho'er, אם נאמר שיוכלו היורשים לדחות לאלמנה ממחצית הנכסים, can the inheritors remove the woman from the one half of the estate that she kept, ושלא תיטול אלא מה שהכניסה לבעל, and she only get the amount of money that she brought in as a dowry to the husband, או דילמה, כיוון שמן המנהג במקום הנשואין שתיטול החצי, since the custom at the time of the marriage was that the wife gets her, ein koch biadam ledchota shekvar zachta b'chatzi hanachasim, because she has acquired half of the property.
I don't understand. There was an explicit clause.
There was an explicit clause at the time of a Christian marriage between two converso Jews.
Okay.
So that there's no ketubah.
A marriage took place in the church in Portugal, and there was an explicit marriage contract which was abiding by Portuguese law. Va'od sha'al ha-sho'el, im tinzal al-mar she-zachta b'chatzi ha-nachasim, im achar k'tirat ha-baal she-nasa v'natna ha-yisha b'nachasim, im tikach gam ken ha-chatzi me-ha-revach, should she get half of the profit because she was running the business, o nomar she-ha-revach kulo le-yitomim. Or should we say that the profits go entirely to the estate? This is the first of a series of six questions having to deal with this case. Do you know who this case is yet? Aviva has figured out who the...
She's famous.
She's almost certainly famous.
Why shouldn't everything be bought? Was it offered twice before she was still Christian? That should be the
other. That's a point of view.
Maybe I don't know.
Tshuva.
It's like she's acclaimed right out of the box.
Havei Yudea, Hashem Yudea, v'hu eid, ki ka'eid tzarot levavi herchivu, ez achezarti koach lashiv sho'alai davar, nupnei ha-kavod al hadin v'al hanet, kefi asher yarunu mi-ha-shamay. ותחילת דבריי וראשית אמרי ואני עתעתי הדין עם האלמנה. The widow is justified בשני החלוקות on both issues of this question. Shezachta b'chatzir nachasim she'iniach ba'ala, v'gam im nasa v'natna b'hen shetitol chatzir ha'revach. Ela shekodem shara'iti leva'er mehecha teisek adata l'ma shelo zachta ha'almona b'chatzir nusakim. On what ground should we say that she hasn't inherited? Ad shehu tzrochu rabanei olam la'arech b'zeh. And that all the great rabbis of the world, and indeed all the great rabbis of the world, dealt with this question. After all, it should appear, בכל הדברים האלו חיוצא בהם מנהג המדינה עיקר ועל פיו דנין והוא שיהיה מנהג פשוט בכל המדינה. In other words, this is an implicit contract between, he doesn't even raise the issue that the marriage is invalid, he says this is an explicit contract between two parties, and whether the marriage is valid or not should not be all that relevant. There was a contract between these two parties, and therefore he raises the issue of why in the world should there be any problem with this. Then he raises all kinds of questions as to why this might not be valid, because these people really didn't intend to stay in Portugal. After all, they were Muranos, and they were going to be doing everything that they could to escape. Let's turn to, and he discusses these in technical details. The key paragraph is on the bottom of the next page. So let's turn to that on the bottom of page 2 of this tshuva. Ela shenireh laniyat da'ati. Do we have that paragraph? Shekol elo hapikpukim hevel hema. All of these issues of questioning whether the initial decision was right or it's just nonsense. Ve'en behem mamash. Achar shehabal niftar makom shenasa uta u'makom shetnatnai haniskar. Since the husband died in the place where in Portugal, and in the place where this clause was made explicit, the bishlama im achash nisru hayu ba'im habal v'yishtamo l'Turkiya. If the husband and wife would have come together with Turkey, vayu osim nisruim kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, and that they would then get married according to Jewish law, hayinu yecholim lomar shekol ma shenasa mikodim lachem batel. That anything that had been done prior to a renewed Jewish marriage is null and void. By yamim harishanim yiplu de ein lacha ela mana umatayim. She would then only be entitled to the minimum amount in the ketubah. Umashachidesh la b'nesuim hashniim shenaseh kedat. Aval achshav sheniftar habal b'makom hanesuim harishanim. But now that the husband actually died in the place of the original marriage, kvar zachta sham haisha b'chatzi nachasim mitzad minhag v'nimus hamalkut. The woman has acquired half the property according to the laws of the land. V'gam mikoach hatnai shetnu b'nehem. Ki lo ya'aleh ahladat l'batel ata hazchut sheshachta sham kvar. It's just completely unreasonable to nullify the rights that she has already acquired in Portugal. D'lo mibayim tapsa v'him mochzeket b'hem. Not only if she has seized the property and is actually in possession, afilu im haitat even if she would have to actually collect this property from the heirs, hayinu motziim, kevan shetekech b'shat tirat haba'al. Naflu hanachasim b'cheskata, because she legally has acquired these properties immediately upon the death of her husband. And here's a beautiful sentence: the imlav came. If you don't decide this way, lo shav kichai l'chol b'nei ha'anusin sheba'u misham v'natsnu v'natnu elu im elu. If not, you'll make chaos amongst all of the Muranos who've come to Turkey on basis of business dealings that they had with one another in Portugal. Yachzuru ata litvoa elu mi elu schuyot v'hashibutim shenasu sham shol kedin tarah. You'll open up a can of worms, because all of the Muranos who've come here and reverted to Judaism will start to claim that all agreements that they had in Turkey in their Murano state are null and void according to Din Torah, and they'll reopen the cases. Such a method of procedure is just completely unacceptable. Ella al mashana asesham na nomar mada avar avar mikam da elech hushban. Whatever took place there is done, and here we start with a new slate. Now, this is a master writing, a man who's in complete mastery of the situation. He's the leading rabbi of Turkey at the time, and he's deciding that it's a can of worms. If you start to open, you have this vast immigration of Murano Jews who are coming to Turkey, and if you start to say that all contracts which were binding, all business dealings and all contracts were binding between them, which took place in Turkey, are null and void because they weren't executed according to the laws of the Torah, then it's just going to be impossible.
What would be rational to think otherwise?
Well,
I just don't see it.
You don't see what?
I don't see what's any flaw in this thinking. From even
between you and me, there's no flaw in this thinking. However, he's not the only rabbi dealing with this case. We have two other great rabbanim whose tshuvos are dealing with this case. The Moshe Detrani, we have a tshuva of his, which is dealing with this case, and he comes down essentially in the same way as Shmuel Medina, and then we have a very angry shuva of the Beis Yosef of the Shulchan Aruch coming down exactly in the opposite, following Mr. Weinstein's lead and rejecting all of this on ideological grounds, as we will see. But I don't think we have time to get to it.
Who's claiming
that? I'm right.
Huh? First of all, we have a picture of the woman. Right.
Who is she? Parlayed that into a nice tiny portion.
This is the biggest case in the 16th century. Let me briefly read. Here. Gracia Nasi, also Beatrice de Luna, La Signora, Luna Dona Beatrice, Mendes Beatrice de Luna. Nasi Gracia, Murano stateswoman and patroness, a member of the first generation of Portuguese Romana Muranos. Her original name was a Christian in Portugal where she was born, was Beatrice de Luna. In 1528, she married Francisco Mendes, also known as Uvain in because all people are Reuven and Shimon. They're anonymous in the Shiva. Okay. Also Murano, who with his brother Diego, who's known as Shimon in the Shiva, Diego Mendes, built up out of a business and precious stones an important banking establishment with a branch in Antwerp, directed by Diego, which soon outdid the main establishment in importance. In 1537, after her husband's death, the widow left Portugal with her family, including her nephew, Wael Migas, or later Joseph Nasi, and went via England to the Low Countries, where she joined her brother-in-law. There she became known in aristocratic society and assisted her brother-in-law in his efforts to aid the fight of the Muranos and to stop the activity of the Inquisition in Portugal. After Diogo's death there in 1543, she fled from Flanders, leaving much of her property behind, and settled in Venice. Here's a real soap opera story. There she was denounced to the authorities as a Judaizer by her own sister, Reina, Diogo's widow. Josa Miguez, however, secured Turkish diplomatic intervention on her behalf, and she was released. She and her family then settled in Ferrara. About this time, she threw off the disguise of Christianity and became known by her Jewish name of Gracia Nasi. In Ferrara, she continued her remarkable work for organizing the flight of fugitive Muranos from Portugal. This is described in Samuel Luscus Consolosan al Tribunosos de Israel, which together with the Ferrara Spanish Bible of 1553 is dedicated to her in admiring terms. In 1553, Gracia Nasi settled in Constantinople, where she continued similar activity. She also patronized scholars and established academies and synagogues in Constantinople and Salonika, and perhaps elsewhere. I should say, in a side remark, she established an Institute of Advanced Studies, Advanced Rabbinic Studies, which had only one director and then many of your visiting scholars, and guess, of course, who was the director? Marashtam, they were Shmuel de Medina. Even so, we can see that he does not decide completely in her favor in these cases. All right. In 1556-57, she attempted to organize a punitive boycott in the port of Ancona in Italy in retaliation for the burning there of 26 Milanos and renegades from the Christian faith. This is described, all of her activities, by the way, are described in this long, beautiful book by Cecil Roth, who's also the author of this article, and of course who's also the editor of the Encyclopedia Today. And this is the one case in Jewish history from maybe the time of the destruction of the temple until modern times that Jews or a Jewish leader tried to take an actual action in opposition to crimes against Jews as opposed to, you know, pleading or bribery or anything else. She tried to organize a boycott. She secured the intervention of the Sultan for some of the accused who were Turkish subjects, including her business agents. In 1554, she was joined in Constantinople by her nephew, who married her only child, Reina, and was now associated closely with all her enterprises, both political and commercial. In 1558 or 1559, she secured from the Sultan in return for an annual payment of 1,000 ducats, a grant of the ruined city in Tiberias in Eretz Israel, where she set up a yeshiva. So the settlement in Tiberias is also due to her. The grant was subsequently renewed with a political motivation by Joseph Nassi. Donna Gracia was certainly the outstanding Jewess of her day and perhaps of the entire period between the fall of the Jewish state and the present. She was known as La Signora or Hagveret, and the synagogue known by this name long continued to exist in Constantinople. She was, however, inactive, perhaps because of in health, for some years before her death, possibly in Eretz Israel in 1569. So we read the beginning of the first of six cases that have to deal with this. We will continue a little bit with the continuation of these cases next week, and we will also see the similar decision by Moshe Detrani and an extremely negative alternative decision by Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, who didn't want to have anything to do with all of these very sensible, rational considerations. Also, motivated, I think,
but there were not Jews. I mean, what's the point?
What do you mean there were not?
Well, the same, you know, you can argue about how can you argue about Christian laws and agreements from a Jewish standpoint? They were not Jews.
They were Jews. They were just
they were not Jews.
Well, they were forcible converts according to Jewish law. They were secret Jews. These were people who were forced converts from Judaism. Christianity.
Yeah, but if you convert it, you convert.
No, not according to Jewish law, and the amount of money involved in this case was huge. We're talking about the equivalent today of hundreds of millions of dollars, and we will go into a little bit more detail. We won't spend the whole of next week's year on this, but we should read a little bit more of the subsequent issues in this case, and also how, whereas both Shmuel de Medina and the Moshe Detrani dealt with this case on the basis of just practical law. You can't open up a can of worms by reopening every single agreement that took place between the people before they arrived in Eretz Israel. The Shulchan Aruch comes to an entirely opposite conclusion, also based, I would say, principally on ideological grounds rather than on the issues. So there's a big difference between someone who actually has to run a large country and is in the practice of dealing with these issues, and someone whose primary concern is theoretical. Writing the Shulchan Aruch is a great achievement, but nevertheless is not the same as running a whole country.
How could you go against Donna Gracia? She did so much of what was the Jewish movement subject.
Well, we're running over time. There are two issues in this case. There was a claim of the heirs of the brother-in-law based on a document that the husband signed saying that half of the property belonged to the brother-in-law. And in other words, the description that Roth gives in the book is not correct. he describes, I'll read to you next time how he describes the case. In fact, Rav Shmuel de Medina, while he decides in her favor on the issue of her control of the husband's estate, decides against her on the issue of what rights her sister has in her case against her on the basis of a deathbed statement of the husband. So even though he was completely in her debt, he nevertheless did not decide completely in her favor. Roth gets it a bit wrong in the description, but we'll come to this next time.
How do we understand involved? This is the case in Turkey.
Yes?
How did the Madit and the Rebbe Kao get involved?
Everybody was turning to everybody. The Sultan, the Sultan, of course, gave the case to Shmuel de Medina. He was the Jewish law had to be in right. But both sides, look, this is going to take
us. Okay,
but we'll do it in Mitzvah Hashem next time.
You told us this logic program in Spain is not.